When thinking about history in general, there are two errors that almost all persons fall into, even historians. One, of course, is the problem of thinking yourself back in history, which we have a great tendency to do, and thinking of how you would react or how you would see things. That is inevitably wrong. You wouldn't be you. You would not have the same values, the same standards, or anything like the same knowledge. You would simply be a totally different kind of person. If some matters of human nature remain much the same, many others change to an extraordinary degree. And the other thing that is boggling is that, of course, people at any one given time know what's important to them, but they have no idea what is going to be important in the future. We have the value of hindsight. We can look back and say, after all, that was not very important, but this was. Now, let me give you a neat example of this. There were three things worth mentioning, perhaps, that happened in the year 1492. One is the one you're bound to think of first: Columbus discovers America. The second one is that the King and Queen of Spain conquer the province of Granada, the last Moorish holdout in Spain. And the third one was that Lorenzo the Magnificent of the House of Medici in Florence died in that year. Now, we have a fairly good idea of the order in which we would rank these things, but at the time they happened, for most of Europe, the most important thing that happened was possibly the conquest of Granada, because by that conquest, indeed, Spain is marked as a coming major power. It has already started that way through the fact that the two great kingdoms were united by marriage. Now that conquest, indeed, heads it toward becoming a major power, hence of interest to all other European powers. Almost as important would be the death of Lorenzo the Magnificent. He is still the head of one of the greatest banking houses in Europe, with branches everywhere, and whatever happens to a Medici is bound to affect the pocketbooks of an awful lot of people. The one thing that didn't matter worth a hoot in hell was the discovery of America. Indeed, the discovery of America whizzes by with so little notice that you would be dazzled by it. The earliest mention of it is in a newsletter, a banking newsletter, from a German in Spain to his home banking house in Augsburg, in which he says, among a lot of other things, in one lone sentence, a man named Christopher Columbus came back and said he discovered a new world. And that's all he has to say about it. No one's interested. No one follows it up with any questions at all. It just simply goes down. Now, if you think back and recognize, there's a very good reason why it didn't cause very much interest. The world was full of unknown worlds in 1492. No one had much of any idea of what was to go on inside Africa until the late 19th century. And indeed, they knew almost nothing about all of China. There are vast portions of the world that are totally unknown. To be told grandly that somebody's got some more is the last thing in the world anyone's going to be interested in. And indeed, no one is. 2 years later, in 1494, the Pope, in fact, draws lines down the map of the world which divide all new territory between Spain and Portugal. So-called Treaty of Tordesillas. This is the one that gives Brazil to Portugal and so on. Does this interest any other European power? Not for a split second. Anybody who wants to lay claim to all that trash out there is welcome. What's going on in Europe is the fact that the King of France has crossed the Alps with an army and is laying claim to the Kingdom of Naples. This is what is on everyone's mind. And this is something that you ought to hold in mind, is that hindsight varies things. Today, 1492 would be listed quite differently, because we think, oddly enough, that America is of vast importance, and discovering it is monumentally important. But this is a little like the fact that about 2 years ago, an astronomer announced that he had discovered one more very small, very bleak planet clear out beyond Neptune and Uranus. And I don't think anyone here, including myself, could even remember the name he gave it. I mean, one more small, frigid planet in our system somehow does not seem madly exciting. Now, 300 years from now, maybe it will be for some reason. But right now, it passes without a ripple. And that's exactly the way the discovery of America goes on here. The eyes of everyone are, in fact, still on Europe. America only begins to be of importance after they discover, in fact, enough precious metals there for this to affect the economy of Spain and hence of Europe. But that's going to be some time. Mexico isn't invaded until 1519 by Cortez, and that doesn't create very much interest either. A little, there seems to be some gold there. That's nice. On the other hand, there's a great deal more gold to be got out of controlling Italy, and what is in fact going on is war between France and Spain in Italy for the basic control of that very rich country. So this is what is occupying the Western world at this time. In other words, their eyes are still basically placed on Europe. They're not looking far beyond this at all. If they're looking anywhere, it is indeed with the Portuguese to the East Indies for the pepper trade. Because if they can tap the pepper, the pepper trade direct, then they don't have to buy through the Turks or other entrepreneurs, and they can make a lot of money. And indeed, this was the value of that. A ship going from Portugal to the Spice Islands and returning, for instance, can get roughly a 500% profit on the cost of the journey. Now, a 500% profit is something worth considering and worth being interested in. Trips to America didn't net anything like that. They were a dead loss, in fact, for a very long time. Now, pepper, there you had something. And you must remember that pepper is important among spices in this period, simply because there is no refrigeration. And in the hot months, when you kill butcher meat and so on, and it hangs around. Of course, you rarely can eat it all at one time. It does tend to become overripe. Now, when it becomes overripe, steak au poivre or pepper steak does indeed cover up a multitude of sins, let us say. Pepper is essential here, hence the value of it and so on. So this is where values are in this period we're talking about. And, of course, judgments and interests go in quite different ways. Indeed, one of the things that people are thinking about and talking about in this period is back to that old and hateful religious problem. And this is, if there is Luther, and if there's a peasants' war, and if there is Anabaptism, and if people like Calvin are beginning to show up in Paris, what is the Catholic Church going to do about this? Because, in fact, it doesn't seem to be doing anything very much at this time. Well, one reason it's not doing anything very much is because the popes are of necessity embroiled in a whole series of wars between France and Spain going on in Italy. And needless to say, first things first, the papacy owns the papal states. They are, in fact, involved in the diplomacy of all of this. It's a pope who calls the Spaniards in the first place. So that this is what the papacy is doing. And then things get more and more out of hand. Eventually you have a Medici pope, Pope Clement VII, who takes the papal tiara, and he gets caught in a terrible bind. Because at just this time, Henry VIII of England is indeed desperately anxious to divorce his wife, Catherine of Aragon. He's had a daughter by her, but no sons. He wants a male heir to the throne. And so, he, since she is now too old to be apt to produce this, what he wants is another wife, and he wants an annulment of that marriage. Now, unfortunately, his wife happens to be the aunt of the Emperor Charles V, who is busy with armies in Italy, and hence the Pope kind of drags his feet and talks and sends messages but doesn't decide anything about it until, of course, finally Henry VIII is going to become cross enough over this to simply cut the papacy off, declare himself the head of the Church of England. And while it's not exactly what you'd call a Protestant Reformation, because in terms of theology, it remains fairly Catholic with bishops and archbishops and all the rest. The only change is, of course, that the head of the church is now the king rather than the pope. Nonetheless, the pope could hardly operate, because in the year 1527, just when Henry is most irate, there is an army belonging to the Emperor Charles V in northern Italy. It's a mercenary army, and it's largely made up of Swiss and German mercenary soldiers. And as was often the case, that army had not been paid with any regularity. And the result was that, not having been paid for quite some time, they decided to take matters in their own hand, and the way to get what you needed seemed to them to attack a city and to loot it. Now, that would it do in lieu of pay, certainly. And who knew what all other things you could get out of this. Now, they started marching south, and they considered Florence. But Florence is a well-fortified city and a difficult one. So they bypassed Florence, and they moved down. And in 1527, they attacked and seized the city of Rome. It's the famous sack of Rome. Indeed, the Pope had to go on a long hustle from the Vatican Palace along the top of the wall to the fortress of Castel San Angelo. There he is besieged by these mercenaries in the hire of the most Catholic emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. Rome itself is looted, pillaged. There are murders. There's quite a lot of rape, of course, as you must expect in these situations. And people being held for ransom, all of the rest of this, so that the Pope is basically a prisoner of the Emperor. And indeed, finally, the Pope will put on rags and escape in the guise of a beggar. He will eventually have a meeting with the Emperor. Now, the Emperor would like to have a church council called, because he would like to find some system whereby the Lutherans can be brought back into the empire. So he's going to apply pressure on the Pope to call a church council to consider this. Now, as it happens, the very last thing that Clement VII wants is a church council. In fact, no pope wants a church council called that he cannot control. They had tried this the century before. That had ended up in the Great Schism. They weren't about to have any more of this, thank you very much. They had spent 100 years reasserting their primal claims. They're not about to give them up. Secondly, Pope Clement VII does not want a church council called because his own position in the papacy is liable to attack if anyone really wants to get up at it. Because he is born illegitimately. And by rule, no pope can be a bastard. While he had, in fact, been technically legitimatized, nonetheless, this did leave an opening whereby enemies could attack him. So Clement VII is determined not to call a church council. And in fact, he is successful. He does not ever call one. The Lutheran heresy is allowed to go right on. He is also successful in one other piece of diplomacy. The House of Medici had been driven out of Florence. Through his meeting with the emperor, he manages to get the House of Medici reinstated as rulers of Florence. So he is successful in his two prime aims. But nonetheless, as all of these heresies began to continue, it became fairly clear that something had to be done within the church itself. Now, certainly, there were moves made by individuals within the church. There were a series of reformers who simply set out to try to reform things that people had been complaining about. In other words, to see that the church runs itself better. Such persons as a bishop of Padua, for instance, went around and saw to it that parish priests were not allowed to keep concubines anymore, and that there was better education for the priesthood, that money matters were put in order, that services were held properly, and that no one was charged indeed for the sacraments. All of this type of reform is put in by individuals, not by the head of the church at all. And it is, in fact, not until around the mid-century that Pope Paul III finally got together a blue ribbon commission to do a study on what is wrong with the church, what needs to be done inside the church. And they produced a famous document called the Concilium. And it began, that was a really intelligent, bold committee, I must say, because that whole statement begins by saying, the basic trouble with the church is that the popes have been misled by lawyers of canon or church law into believing that all things that pertain to the church are their personal and private possessions, that they can dispose of them or sell them as they choose. This is not the case. And if this were stopped, and if the papacy would stop trying to assume this position, things would be a great deal better. Now, this is to attack, indeed, the very foundations of the way the papacy was working at this time. Beyond that, it went on to say that, in fact, people should not hold several jobs at the same time, which they can't do, and take the money, pluralism. They went on to state that no church offices should ever be sold. This is the sin of simony. And they went on to say that, for heaven's sake, isn't it about time we tried educating the priests a little, so they might understand something? And they went on to insist that the monasteries and nunneries needed more supervision in every respect. And they went on and on, a long list of these abuses within the church. Now, it did create a lot of interest. Not that the Pope was so delighted with it, but Luther was extremely delighted with it. He immediately had it printed up in Northern Europe with annotations on the margin, saying, see, it's just what I said, they admitted themselves, no damn good. So it became a rather notorious document, which the church did try to bury. On the other hand, of course, eventually something did have to be done, and what was done was to call the famous Council of Trent. A Council of Trent is summoned by Pope Paul III in 1545, and it will continue to hold meetings until 1563. This is for a period of 18 years. Now, I don't want you to think that it meets for 18 years consecutively, because there is, in fact, one period of 10 years in there in which no meetings are held at all. One of the popes along there didn't approve of the council, so he simply never called it back. And there are several sets of big meetings. It met in the city of Trent, which is in imperial territory, but is the nearest city in imperial territory to Italy. It is today a part of Italy. And that council, from beginning to end, is under the control of the papacy. Out of over 300 members who sat in it at one time or another, over 280 are Italian. There were a certain number of Spaniards. There was a consignment of French, though the French were called back by the King of France out of one whole group of meetings. and there were scattered persons from outside. And what the Council of Trent was charged with doing was, first of all, defining what church doctrine is. What did you have to believe in? And hence, what is heretical? So they went through all of these things which have been being argued about for the last 100 years. And now they began to straighten things up. What they did, in fact, was to go back and to reaffirm the medieval position. The Council of Trent is basically highly conservative. That is, they confirm the seven sacraments, they confirm the concept of continuing revelations, they take up the concept of the validity of worship of saints, and so on. They waffle a bit about indulgences. They say, technically it's all right, but let's not do it very much. They waffle on a few other things. But as a whole, what it does is to establish now very clear lines whereby you can determine what is Catholic and what is Protestant. In other words, what is heresy? And for the first time, this is cleared up positively. Now, the Council of Trent also took up some other factors. It's notable that they took up the problem of education. And it had a whole series of humanists who were at the Council of Trent, and they, of course, assumed that the new education would go along humanist lines. In other words, a kind of historical approach to Christianity would be taken for granted. And it looked as though they had the vote, but at the last minute, a Dominican rose and gave an impassioned plea for old-time medieval scholasticism as the proper method, insisting that if this were thrown out, that this would indeed encourage the Lutherans, and so on. And the result was that the council voted against humanism. Now, as a result, humanism tends, in fact, to lose out. The initial gains it made in the 15th century, the early 16th, are held, but nonetheless, scholasticism does an astonishing rebound in the later 16th century, is still being taught in the 17th century in major universities. I warned you, this is a highly conservative Council of Trent. All right, that's one fact. Now, they also tried to deal with some other things. They tried to deal with the fact that in the old days, when books were handwritten and copied, you stood a good chance of being able to burn heretical literature faster than it could be copied. This was a fair chance. But by this time, there were loads and loads of printing presses, particularly up in heretical countries, that are churning out heresy hand over fist. Now, how do you deal with this mass of heretical literature, which obviously you don't want good Catholics to read? So what they put together was the so-called Index of Prohibited Books or Works, in which they listed the books that no Catholic was to be allowed to read, except, of course, by special permission. Now, indeed, the first edition of this was put together rather hastily, and there was a tendency then to follow along this. What they did in the first edition was to simply list authors and say everything by this author is forbidden. They also listed a certain number of printing presses and said, anything they publish you can't read. They didn't have time to go through all of it, but they knew it was bound to be dreadful and heretical, so that's out. So it became an increasingly kind of inclusive thing. Now, new editions continue to be brought out of the Index of Prohibited Works. By the time you reach the 18th century, if you aren't on the Index of Prohibited Works, it is a little like not being banned in Boston in the 1930s. You were an intellectual nobody if you weren't on this. All of Erasmus's works are on it, Galileo's, name almost anyone, he's on the Index of Prohibited Works. Now, this eventually reaches the kind of point of no return in the 18th century in Austria, where the Empress Maria Theresa was an extremely conservative, rigid Catholic. And she felt far too many people were reading the wrong books. So what she did was to see that included on the index of prohibited works was the index of prohibited works. Since she considered this was an easy reader's guide to what you shouldn't be reading. And this is the kind of ultimate reduction to absurdity of this kind of censorship. I might add that it has had, of course, some other rather stunning results, because, of course, copies of all of these works were usually sent to the Vatican to be checked out. Anything questionable was sent there, remained in the Vatican Library. And the result of this is, I understand on good authority, but I'm sorry to say, not on personal experience, the greatest collection of pornography in the world is in the Vatican Library. It is the envy of the University of Indiana's Kinsey Institute. The other thing, of course, that was done at this same time, the Council of Trent, was to reestablish the Papal Inquisition. Now, the Papal Inquisition is not the Spanish Inquisition. These are two totally separate things. And indeed, it is the Spanish Inquisition which has the terrible reputation. The Papal Inquisition does manage to burn a few people. But as a whole, it's a fairly ineffective and mild form of Inquisition. It operates only inside Italy itself, not outside of Italy. The Spanish Inquisition is something else, of course. The Spanish Inquisition was founded by the Spanish king, and it was founded really specifically as a, in the first place, as a money-making operation. It was headed and aimed specifically at Moors and Jews who claimed to have become Christians, and what it did was to confiscate their estates if it could prove otherwise. Hence, it was of enormous financial value to the kingdom, and indeed, it was criticized by the papacy very intensely as not being a proper inquisition at all, but simply a money grab. But it continued. The papacy could not put it down. Later, of course, it was to have a very long history of, indeed, the famous autos da fe and so on, the torture chambers, used, of course, against Jews and Moors until both were driven out of Spain eventually, but then utilized against any heretics found within Spanish dominions, of course, so that English sailors had a kind of horror of the Spanish Inquisition as well. But that was a far more rigid affair than the Papal Inquisition. I might add the basic concept with the Inquisition is that you are, in fact, guilty unless you can prove your innocence. It is the exact reverse from our legal assumptions today. This is indeed a dread thing to belong to. There are various kinds of punishments, including confiscation of property, and, of course, punishment by death. And the fact we tend to think of them, I must say, as being the principal instrument of legal torture in this world. This is not true. Legal torture is omnipresent everywhere throughout the 16th, the 17th, and into the 18th century. This is par for the course, in fact. Elizabeth tortures people in England. They are tortured in France. They are tortured in Italy. You are put to the rack. There are a whole splendid variety of tortures invented. And, of course, for treason, there are rather spectacular death penalties. The hang, drawn, and quartered is, of course, the most commonplace. This means that you are, in fact, hanged to begin with, and cut down while you are still alive. You are then slit open in the belly and your bowels are dragged out and thrown on a fire while you are still living and can watch this. And only after this and various other things are you beheaded and then chopped into quarters and sent around to be displayed over gates of various cities. Now, this is par for the course throughout Europe. You must think of the Spanish Inquisition with all of its horrors along with this. I warned you that you should not think yourself back in time, that things would be a little different. Let me point out that there's a famous case of an assassin in the 16th century who killed William the Silent of Holland. Now, persons who did this are put to death in long and peculiarly harrowing fashions. The death is strung out so that it will last 6, 8, 10 hours. It begins with such things as tearing off bits of flesh with red hot pincers, which then, of course, these sear the wound so that you don't bleed to death in the meantime. You'd be surprised how many small pieces can be taken off this way. You do an awful lot of screaming before this whole thing gets to an end. All right. Now, this is going on, a very lengthy ceremony with large crowds applauding, loving all of it. And there's one poor woman in the crowd who finally just has enough. Hey, you're sick. And so she turns her head away. I don't feel well. And the crowd almost lynches and kills her because she is not enjoying and applauding this as any proper person should. Now, there's your 16th century reaction for it. And I bet none of you think yourself successfully back into that position. You're always going to be, all of you are going to be that little girl, that woman who gets sick at the stomach.
Me too.
But this is the sort of thing I mean, that things are simply different. Okay. So we have now established that the Catholics are beginning to move now to establish, lay down the rules for heresy, to establish some attempt at dealing with heretical literature and with heretics, and there are various new orders that are founded. Now, the most famous of all of these, and there are a whole set of counter-reformation saints, is, of course, Saint Ignatius Loyola. He's the founder of the Jesuit order, and the Jesuits have been omnipresent almost ever since. Now, Ignatius Loyola is Spanish. He comes from the Basque country, clear up in the north of Spain, mountain territory. He came from the lesser nobility up there. And he starts life as a soldier, and he was a good soldier. He was a rather short man, but very fierce. And in fact, in a war against the French fought up there, he is wounded in battle. His leg is shattered, in fact. But he had fought so bravely that the French themselves pick him up and carry him off so that he can be nursed back to health. He's first in a nunnery. Later, he managed to be sent home. And, of course, while he's laid up, he wants something to read. Now, what he asked for were some of the more popular romances of the day, like Amadis de Gaul. They didn't have any of these. All they had were little books that dealt with lives of saints and things like this. Well, it wasn't exactly what he had in mind to read, but if there was nothing else, he would read it. And he did. And what happened, of course, is a kind of revelation that changes his life. He gives up being a soldier. He takes, indeed, to, first of all, to becoming a hermit. And he goes up and he lives for some time as a hermit, dirty, unkempt, half-starved, devoting himself totally to prayer. But then he decides that this really is not the proper method. That while this may be efficacious in winning himself salvation, that persons really ought to go out and face the problems of the world and do something about them, that this would be more Christian. So, in fact, he now, indeed, goes off on pilgrimage to Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem at this time is, of course, owned by the Arabs, but Franciscans are in charge of Christians there. Ignatius Loyola arrives, he's all fired up with his Christian duty. What he does is tear around town, grabbing Saracens by the coat lapels and saying, "Listen, I've got something to tell you about Christ. I'm going to convert you. You've got to become Christian." The Franciscans simply go up to him and say, "You're making an awful lot of trouble in this town, kid. Out." And he is shipped out of Jerusalem. He goes back to Spain. Well, he decides that he's better studying theology. So he goes, indeed, to the University of Salamanca, but he continues to sort of preach around what he thinks is right. So he's kicked out of that university. He goes to another university, he's kicked out of that one, he finally ends up at the University of Paris, he finally completes his theological degree in Paris. And he meets some others. And they go up on the hill of Montmartre, and they swear, indeed, a special oath to stay together to work for the church. And this is the first beginning of the group of Jesuits. Now, they're a rather mixed group. Basques, there's a Portuguese, there are two French, there's some Spaniards, and so on. And they decide they'll go to Jerusalem first. But they can't get to Jerusalem because Venice, the only passage there, is at war. So they agree to go down to Rome. And in Rome, there's a terrible winter of famine and plague. And they apply themselves to taking care of the sick and the hungry and the needy. They devote themselves to this with such energy that they come to the attention of cardinals and even in the papacy itself. And since they can't get to Jerusalem, they finally ask the Pope to be allowed to found a new order, which will be called the Company or the Society of Jesus. Now, he grants them permission because of what they have done. First, they're to be allowed to have only 60 members. Later, within months, in fact, that restriction is taken off. This is the beginning, then, of the Jesuit order. Now, this is in the mid-16th century. And Ignatius Loyola is, of course, the first captain general of the Society of Jesus. Now, the importance of this particular religious order is that it is going to be the spearhead of the Catholic attack against Protestantism. They are the militant order, and they are quite different from any other order in various ways. For one thing, they do not have to wear any kind of identifying costume or clothing, as all monks or priests had. And this means that they can travel about with great ease. Indeed, this is one thing that is to give them an unenviable reputation for being spies, of course, particularly in England. And in fact, they do operate that way at times also. It's part of their business to do this against heretics. So, this is one thing. Another thing, of course, is the fact that they take the usual oaths of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and the special oath of obedience to the papacy. They are to be his right-hand troops. They also, very quickly, tend to take a very special kind of approach. Ignatius Loyola himself wrote a small book called The Spiritual Exercises, which is a guide to meditation, in which the person who follows this is asked to sit in a darkened room and to meditate on a very specific chain of things presented to him. What he meditates on specifically is the teaching and the passion of Christ, the crucifixion, the descent into limbo, the final ascent to paradise. And what the book suggests is that you think seriously about this in a darkened room, and that you try, in fact, to experience yourself what is going on, so that the instructions are, in fact, couched in such ways that at the crucifixion, you are asked, indeed, to try to hear the ring of the hammers on the nails, to feel the nails piercing your flesh, to taste the vinegar on the sponge. In other words, to open up all the senses to trying to re-experience this kind of thing in a kind of totality. Now, what this can lead to, of course, is an extraordinarily powerful emotional and mystical experience. There's no question about this. And what it does, in actual fact, is to set one of the patterns that are going to be followed up, particularly in the 17th century, as an attack against Protestantism. If you stop and think, the Protestants, particularly the Calvinists, have used the weapon of logic. If you accept Calvin's premises, It goes on from axiom right on down the line to prove its point logically, exquisitely, clearly, and perfectly. Okay. Now there is only one good weapon against rationalism or reason, and this is the emotions. The emotions is the only way in which you can simply bypass reason totally. It is the sort of thing that you get into with intuition and so on, so that you simply bypass reason. So it is, in fact, the one extremely potent weapon. Now, this means, of course, that what you are going to have coming up is an age in which Catholicism will A, dramatize the church, glorify the church. You will have great church music. You will have great masses written. You will have all kind of panoply, ceremony, all of this, which will all work together to give you a really emotional bang out of all of this. In other words, it doesn't try to be reasonable. It just tries to grab you and take you with it. Now, much of that comes out of this particular aspect, which Loyola was clever enough to see. Now, the Jesuits also carry on in three other specific ways. One of these is that they are spectacular missionaries. It is the Jesuits in particular who become the great missionaries to the Orient. It is one of the founding fathers, St. Francis Xavier, who goes to India, settles in Goa down there, which is still a highly Christianized section of India. He goes on to preach Christianity in Japan, where he converts, in fact, an astonishing number, thousands of Japanese are converted by St. Francis Xavier. He is planning, indeed, on going to China when he dies. He is today buried in the silver shrine of the cathedral at Goa. But it's notable that the Jesuits follow along and do go into China, and that by the 17th century, almost everything that the West knows about China comes from the Jesuits. Jesuit writings about China is the base of most Western knowledge. Now, in addition to that kind of missionary work, they operate in England against areas which have become Protestant. And they begin to recover territories. Hungary, Austria, Poland, all of these areas, Calvinism is basically driven out, so they operate very successfully there. This is also missionary work. A second way in which they operate is that they very quickly get into education. And of course, this is what we tend to think of today. Almost every major Catholic college or university in America today is Jesuit, of course. It's true throughout much of Europe as well. And here, of course, they come up against the Dominicans and Franciscans, but tend to be highly successful. It's notable that they introduce a new concept into the university, first of all in Paris, at the Jesuit college there. For the first time, the people who run the college make the assumption that they are responsible for the moral welfare of the students in the college. And they will indeed begin to establish dormitories and to have certain hours to make sure indeed that they go to chapel, all the rest of these things, for their moral welfare. And they begin the process of establishing age classes. The sort of thing which you take for granted today really begins at that time. Up to this time, there had been no concept of moral welfare, and this is now introduced, end of the 16th century, by the Jesuits. As a concept, it will continue, of course, basically down to World War II, and will begin under the impact of you people who crumble out and disappear totally. The other thing that the Jesuits go in for is the fact that they become very popular as confessors to rulers and monarchs. And this is because Ignatius Loyola himself pointed out that rulers, monarchs, are God's appointed agents on this earth. They are very busy men, they have lots of responsibility, and as a result, they should be treated more leniently than other persons. And the result, of course, was that Jesuit confessors became very popular. Instead of having to do long penances, you could do a couple of Hail Marys and you're out of purgatory one more time. It did give them the ear of monarchs and place them in this kind of position. So you will note that they are social, they are theological, and they are also highly political. They have a tendency to hang on to those three areas for a long time. Go home.